This is Examining Education. I'm Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Today's program looks at how we teach reading. People are pretty much in agreement about the importance of reading. In one of his many speeches about education, President Obama points out that, quote, reading is the gateway skill that makes all other learning possible, from complex word problems and the meaning of our history to scientific discovery and technological proficiency. In a knowledge economy, he asks, where this kind of learning is necessary for survival, how can we send our kids out into the world if they're only reading at fourth grade level? The difficulty is that although everyone feels strongly about the importance of reading, there has been much debate about what method is best for teaching people to read proficiently. As it turns out, the debate about the best method to teach reading has been going on for hundreds of years. This debate became particularly heated in the last years of the 20th century, when it was described as a war between supporters of phonics and supporters of whole language. Although an uneasy truce of sorts has been declared, with the whole language people accepting that a healthy dose of systematic phonics be included in all early reading instruction, it seems a complete resolution will never come about. Not only is it not possible to find all the evidence absolutely supporting one side or the other, but many see the debate as being about a more general division in our approach to teaching. Do we put the child first, or the program first? Are we inclined to focus on the individual and tailor instruction uniquely to that child, or do we focus on constructing a well-designed, logically developed curriculum which the child needs to master? Here to give us an overall understanding of the background of these debates about the best way to teach reading is David Pearson of the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome to our program. First, can you tell us about your own involvement with reading instruction?
Well, I've been either teaching reading or teaching teachers how to teach reading since 1964, when I became a classroom teacher in Porterville, California. So I've been at it a long time. This is my 43rd year as a college professor and, teaching courses on how to teach reading and on research in reading.
Well, can you give us a sketch of the history of the general debate among people about the best ways to teach reading?
Well, since the first person taught someone else how to read, there's been a debate about the best way to do that. And if you go back to, Germany, and if you go back to England, and if you go back to the colonial United States, people debated about whether, an alphabetic approach, in which we learned all the letter names and then the letter sounds and then how to blend them together, or whether we learned each word and its pronunciation and meaning. That was the original debate, sort of alphabetic approach versus whole word approach. That debate's been going on for at least 500 years, and it emerges in one form or another every 20 or 30 years as regular as clockwork or Halley's Comet. The current iteration of it, I suppose that in the 90s we had the sort of phonics first versus whole language. That was probably the most serious of these curricular debates. And that went on for about late 1970s through the late 1990s. And then whole language was sort of wiped out as a curricular force. But the fundamental debate between whole language and phonics was in the early stages of reading. Do we teach the kids the code, how to translate letters into sounds, and then how to blend them together into words, and then once they blended them together, rely on their listening comprehension to get meaning? That is, if you can decode the words and you can say them to yourself, then presumably you can understand them the same way that you understand words when you listen to other people speak. The whole language people and those who generally believe that reading is a more constructive process said, no, you go for meaning from the beginning. The point about it is not to ever have kids barking at print, but rather to have them always have a set to translate those squiggles on the page into something that makes sense. Is reading a matter of accurately decoding letters into sounds, or is reading always about making sense of what's on the page?
Uh-huh. So I can see why some people would be very opposed to an assessment such as the Dibbles, and some people would be quite in favor of it.
Exactly.
Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, the Dibbles is a very popular so-called progress monitoring assessment that's very widely used in the wake of No Child Left Behind all around the United States. And what Dibbles does is it measures things like kids' knowledge of letter names, their knowledge of letter sounds, their knowledge of the different separate sounds in the language, what we call phonemic awareness. It also measures, kids' ability to retell stories. And what Dibbles does is, instead of just knowing whether you can name the letters accurately or you can name the letter sounds accurately, it puts things on a rate metric, okay? And how many letters can you name in a minute? How many letter sounds can you name in a minute? How many words can you read correctly in a minute, and the like? So it translates everything into a rate, and it's a very appealing test because it's pretty quick, pretty easy to administer, and it's supposed to be what we call a progress monitoring test. And what I mean by that is, like, every so often, like once a month, you go in and you give the Dibbles and you sort of see where kids are and what progress they've made from the previous month. And then on the basis of that sort of benchmark assessment, you might say, hey, wait a minute, I better go back and do more teaching of this or that. Or that.
Mm-hmm.
Dibbles is not supposed to be a diagnostic test. The makers of Dibbles, the folks at the University of Oregon, never purported that it could be used, you know, to diagnose which letter names or which letter sounds or which phonemes or kids or which words kids needed to learn to read. It was only sort of like, you know how we use a thermometer to take your temperature?
Mm-hmm.
But that just tells us whether you're sick or not. It doesn't tell us exactly what's wrong. We still need other diagnostic tools to determine that.
Mm-hmm.
And Dibbles is more like a thermometer than it is like, a blood test, which could be used to rule out a specific problem that you had. And the problem, of course, is that people can't resist using a test like Dibbles diagnostically, so that if kids aren't reading enough, words per minute correctly, or if they aren't naming enough letters per minute, correctly, then the temptation is to teach kids to read faster.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we want kids to read faster, but not because we practice reading faster 15 times a week, but rather because we taught everything so well, including word recognition, comprehension, all the elements of the school curriculum, reading curriculum. We taught it all so well that you end up reading faster.
Mm-hmm.
But so reading faster is a symptom, not a goal.
Well, would you say any of these debates have been resolved or moderated?
Well, I think what happens is each time we go through one of these debates, and by the way, these debates are almost always one version or another of one side takes what I would call a child-centered view of what teaching and learning are about, and that is you have to figure out what the child can do, what the child knows, what the child needs, and then you adapt the curriculum to the child, versus what I would call a curriculum-centered view, which says, we pretty much know what the steps you need to go through to become a good reader, and here they are, and we're going to put you through them. So, you've got child-centered views of teaching and learning versus curriculum-centered views, and if you look at all these debates across the last couple of hundred years, they almost always end up being that kind of tension between, do we teach the child and adapt the curriculum, or do we teach the curriculum and ask the child to adapt? Have they been resolved? Not completely, and the reason that they're never completely resolved is that the evidence, while it might tip one way or another, is never so compelling and so clearly one-sided that the other side doesn't have a leg to stand on, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like black and white or night and day. It's not like kids never learn to read using whole language, or always learn to read using phonics, or vice versa. A lot of kids learn to read, irrespective of the method you use to teach them. And so it's not like the data are so black and white that we can settle the issue, once and for all.
Well, what's the role of federal government in this debate?
Well, the federal government has always wanted to improve children's literacy, and its first foray into this was in the 1960s when it sponsored what was called the First Grade Studies, which was supposed to be a set of experiments that would determine once and for all what the best way to teach reading was. And they sponsored that very large project in the middle 60s, and what they found it wasn't so much the method, but it was the quality of the pedagogy that kids got, and the nature of the program. That is, one of the conclusions from the First Grade Studies that everyone cites is that it was the teacher, not the method of teaching reading, that made the most difference. My reading of that study is a little different. There is some reason to believe that some programs are better than others. And I think the First Grade Studies, as well as Jean Charles' work in that time period, shows that an early emphasis on phonics gets kids off to a really good start. But that was the federal government's first foray. It was research, and the federal government pretty much stayed in the research funding cycle until the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 came along, Title I. And then they started funding what we call compensatory education. That is, we look at the kids who aren't succeeding, and we give extra money to schools that have a high incidence of either low-performing or low-income kids, and we provide an extra boost to those schools. And, that kind of funding has been with us for the last, almost 50 years now, of federal funding for Title I, and it's, it comes under different names, like the Improving America Schools Act in the Clinton administration, and No Child Left Behind in the Bush administration, and I guess, whatever version we currently have in the Obama administration, the federal government's role has been to provide additional resources to help precisely that set of schools whose performance we worry the most.
Well, how do the Common Core state standards fit into this discussion?
Well, there's the Common Core state standards, which have been around for about 18 months now in English language arts and mathematics, are yet another attempt to bring some consistency and standardization to curriculum across the United States, and recognize that these are not a federal program. This is a national program. It's sponsored by, the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers, and it's a completely voluntary thing. No one is forcing any state to be a part of the Common Core standards. And I think so far, somewhere around 43 or 44 or 45 states have signed on. I can never remember the exact number, and it does change from one week to the next. Mm-hmm. But the point is that these are standards that each state is going to say, well, we're going to hold our schools and teachers and kids accountable to these standards, and we're going to participate with these two large consortia of states that are producing assessments to measure whether or not kids have met these standards, and we're going to use these to monitor the quality of teaching and learning in our schools. Mm-hmm. And so it's a whole new, yet another new accountability movement. And I guess the question is that the tests that they produce in this new Common Core Standards movement may move us in a different direction from, for example, the Dibbles tests that were such a prominent part of No Child Left Behind. The other thing that the Common Core state standards do that's very different from the No Child Left Behind reform movement is that they start at the end of high school. These are Common Core state standards for college and career readiness. Mm-hmm. And they sort of specify, here's what you know and need to know and be able to do to go to college or to go out in the workplace and assume a position of responsibility. And now we're going to backwards map down through high school and through the middle school and into the elementary school to figure out a trajectory for getting you to the point where you can go out and be college and career ready.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a much more, if you will, upper upper elementary, middle, and high school focus.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much of an early elementary focus as No Child Left Behind. They have a much more emphasis on in reading on comprehension and writing and using what you learn from reading to solve problems and the like, and much less there's a hand wave in the Common Core standards to the foundational skills of phonemic awareness and fluency and decoding and word recognition. But the real emphasis in the Common Core standards is on higher order processes, and particularly comprehension and critical reading and using what you've learned to apply to new situations. As I say, it's much more focused on getting kids ready for the kind of experiences they'll have in colleges and in the workplace.
What do you see as the role of textbook companies in this area?
Well, I mean, I think the role of textbook companies is to make it easier for teachers to follow the standards. And so what the various textbook companies will do is, I assume, that they will adapt their current curricular approaches to the Common Core standards, and they'll start using the language of the Common Core, and hopefully beyond the language, they'll start infusing curricular experiences that actually prepare kids to be able to complete assessment tasks that have been developed with the Common Core in mind. And so I fully expect that all of the basal reading companies and the high school and middle school literature anthologies and science textbooks. I don't know about social studies because it never seems to get included in the Common Core, but definitely for language arts and math and science, I think you're going to see a mix up in the emphasis on the curricular emphasis, and in particular on the nature of reading and writing tasks that kids are asked to do.
Well, let me ask you, when you made the division between child-centered and curriculum-centered, what about the Common Core State Standards?
It's very curriculum-centered, very curriculum-centered. You know, the whole idea is that we lay out what kids know and need to be able to do in order to meet these standards, and then, we find ways of making sure that kids can do them. So it's kids and schools that have to adapt, not the, it's kids who have to adapt, and I guess teachers. It's not the curriculum and the schools. So they're gonna follow the lead of the standards. I would say that this is a very curriculum-centric reform movement.
What do you see in the next few years happening with reading instruction?
I think because of the Common Core, the pendulum will swing back to a greater emphasis on, understanding text, to making meaning and when you read text, and less emphasis on phonics. We'll be in a little bit of a movement back to problem solving and. And I also see the possibility of integrated curriculum, and by that I mean a lot of emphasis on using reading, writing, and oral language to learn science or to learn social studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we'll see a movement in that direction for the next 5 or 6 years.
We've been talking to David Pearson of the University of California at Berkeley. Coming up, we move beyond the reading wars and talk to someone whose research has identified her as a supporter of systematic phonics and who favors using a logically developed and well-designed curriculum. This is Examining Education. Next on the program is Barbara Foreman, director of the Florida Center for Reading Research at Florida State University. Welcome to the program. Can you tell us about your own involvement with reading instruction?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I have been involved over the last 30 years in teaching reading, both in the middle school level and ESL level, and in early childhood settings, as well as teaching struggling readers in reading remediation in high school and in clinics. And I've also supervised student teachers in reading, both in pre-service, and then I have done many in-service workshops for teachers. And I've been in the university setting teaching graduate students about reading instruction, and I have conducted research with federally funded grants over the last 30 years, observing and reading instruction in elementary classrooms in Texas, in the District of Columbia Public Schools. And I've also developed reading assessments that inform instruction for the states of Texas and now Florida, where I'm located.
Well, what do you see as most important in effective reading instruction?
It's important to keep the focus on understanding what you're reading, because that's why we read. But it's important to build the knowledge and skills to get to full understanding of what you're reading. So the most general things to focus on are oral language development, alphabetic mastery, because English is an alphabetic language, and then practice reading connected text with a gradual release of responsibility for the student doing all the reading, not the adult. And then to do this reading instruction in a differentiated fashion, meaning that students can be grouped for specific instruction with the teacher and then regrouped as their skills change with material that fits their needs. These are what I call foundational skills, and I think the oral language piece has often been missing, so I want to emphasize the importance of oral language starting in pre-K and going all the way through the primary grades, even while we're working on decoding, which obviously is going to have some texts that are more controlled. And that oral language work needs to focus on what people are calling academic language, which is more abstract language. It's not how we talk every day. It's the language of the way textbooks are written, and we need to help students learn those kind of words that we don't use every day but appear in text quite frequently. We need to help them with narrative skills as well as expository skills, and this is all oral, and we need to help them develop their vocabulary, not just a definition of a word as it appears in a text, but understanding the multiple meanings of that word as you'd find it in a dictionary, has often many different meanings.
Well, what do you see as the most salient issues with the current state of reading instruction?
I think the most salient issues are a lack of focus on pre-K through grade 2 for reading, because our accountability system focuses the schools on grades 3 to 12. And that's where the best teachers are often put, whereas I think for reading purposes, the best teachers need to be at kindergarten and first grade, because that's special time. Kids are so excited about learning to read, and it's just a shame if they fall behind right from the beginning.
Well, now, what is your opinion of the Common Core State Standards in English Language Arts that have now been adopted by, I think, at least 47 states?
Right. Well, I was a reviewer on them, so I have to admit I might be biased. I think they're a great idea. The idea of having common standards across states is very attractive. Also, the idea of having standards that are geared towards college and workplace readiness, in other words, standards which exceed almost all the current state standards, except perhaps Massachusetts. So I have a favorable opinion with them in that regard. I do worry that in these physically tight times that there won't be adequate resources for the massive professional development needed, because these standards are quite a paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Well, there's much more emphasis on writing, speaking, listening, and language, and more emphasis on text analysis. And throughout all of this, those new emphases, the underlying principles are really coming from cognitive developmental psychology, that we have to understand how our students think and look at their mistakes or misconceptions to understand where they are developmentally on a continuum, and then relate our instruction to where they are based on that thinking. And that the most teachers, you know, haven't been given a course in cognitive developmental psychology, unfortunately, or not to the extent to link it to instruction. I know, because I teach in a school of teacher education here at Florida State University, and I'm trying to do this, and it's even difficult at the graduate level. The undergraduate teacher certification program isn't even close to doing this. So that's what worries me. The good news is the Common Core, I think, are elegant and really geared towards what we do in the workplace, where we need speaking and listening skills, we need good writing skills, we analyze, even on the internet, you're comparing across text, you're coming up with written responses. This is so much more demanding than our current state standards.
Of course, the assessment can be complicated, too.
Well, yes, I was going to say, the whole issue of what's going to happen in the future, so with reading instruction, so much of that depends on these Common Core assessments that are being developed by two different state consortia. They're struggling, and for good reason, because the standards are very demanding, and there's a lot of pushback from states, both in terms of the cost of the technology to do the kinds of assessments they would like to do, internet-based, written response, you know, or constructed response, comparing more than one text. Most state tests now just have one text. So I think there's just so much promise, but in this time of physical constraints, it's very hard, I think, to realize the promise.
Well, what changes, if any, would you make in the standards?
Yeah, as a reviewer, that's tough. I mean, I'm generally very supportive, but we also here at FCRR, Florida Center for Reading Research, we have a grant from our contract from the U.S. Department of Education via RMC Corporation to work on the Center on Instruction. We're the literacy strand, so we work with state departments of education and regional comprehensive centers across the United States to give them technical assistance on English language arts literacy. And for the past year, we've been flooded with questions about the Common Core. And the first question from many states was, where's reading? Because the Common Core is separated into several strands, and reading is, you have a foundational skill set, but reading is sort of distributed. And you find a lot of it in the language conventions part, and then also through writing and speaking and listening. So we've actually put together a document to show people where reading was. I think their confusion was they were oriented towards the fabulous five components of reading from Reading First, and they couldn't find them in these documents. So we have helped them with finding them. The other thing, I think that a lot of good information's in the appendix, and I really hope people read the appendices. Like Appendix C is fabulous examples of writing, students writing and annotations on their writing. Appendix B has performance assessment items. And then Appendix A goes into text complexity, and it has all the list of the reading progression that people are eager to see.
Before I ask my next question, I need to explain to our audience what the Fabulous Five you've just referred to are. They are the five components, phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension, that the Department of Education's Reading First program required be included in any Title I reading program that sought the department's funding. I need also to mention that the intense focus on just these five elements was a result of the 2001 report of the National Reading Panel. This was a report that was commissioned by Congress. I know many people, including David Pearson, with whom we first spoke, have found such a narrow focus on a subset of skills harmful and welcome the inclusion of writing and oral language development and the attention to texts that the Common Core state standards are bringing.
What should families look for in evaluating the reading instruction that their students are experiencing in school?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, having been a parent myself and on being on the other side of the desk, so to speak, with my daughter's teacher, it's really important that parents have good contact with their school and their teacher, and that they sit down and talk about how their child is doing, hopefully with some data. You know, this is really important that the teacher have some data that they can share with the teacher about how their student is doing. And it could be as simple as some formative assessment, which the teacher uses in her classroom. You know, here's an example of your child's writing. And but formatives are good, but a parent has the right to know how their child is comparing to peers nationally. Otherwise, they don't have a really good sense of whether their child is so-called on grade level or not. So, for example, in Florida, for the Florida Department of Ed, we designed an assessment that Florida owns and uses, where the basic skills of reading and then reading comprehension and listening comprehension are linked to the Stanford Achievement Test through logistic regression. So you don't have, your child hasn't taken the Stanford Achievement Test, but their scores are linked to that to predict whether they'll be on grade level or not. So we're actually issuing letters home to parents, not we, the Florida Department of Ed is, that provides the parent with their scores, and then in their parent-teacher conference, the teacher goes over these scores and can explain how well their child is doing, not just in the context of the 18 to 20 children in that classroom, but also in the context of, and not just in the context of Florida children, but in the context of nationally what you'd expect a kindergarten child or a first grade child to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you see in the next few years happening with reading instruction?
Well, I think that, you know, I think there is a lot of buy-in to the Common Core at the grassroots level in terms of people who know reading and they're excited about the emphasis on oral language and writing and speaking, listening. But I think there's just a whole lot of pushback in implementing them. So I think the next few years we're going to see how that pushback plays out because of the lack of resources in the states to do good professional development and the pressure on teachers to be accountable for their students' achievement if they want to get a merit raise or keep their jobs. Mm-hmm. So all of these are very negative factors in terms of what's going to happen with reading instruction. There's so much promise with the Common Core, but I just think it's caught up in a spiral of fiscal and mean-spirited evaluation and accountability.
We've just been talking to Barbara Foreman, director of the Florida Center for Reading Research at Florida State University. In a moment, we'll be talking to a longtime advocate for whole language who holds strong opinions about where the emphasis should be placed when teaching students to read. This is Examining Education. Our next guest is Richard Allington of the University of Tennessee. Welcome to our program. Can you tell us about your own involvement with reading instruction?
Sure. It all began, 40-some years ago as I arrived as a brand-new elementary school teacher in a high-poverty rural school district and found out that, first of all, the system had no actual plan for teaching kids to read. And my classroom had a scholastic classroom library, which was what I was told I could use. But I soon found out that perhaps because I was the new teacher, and because it was a fourth, fifth grade combination, and because everybody read below the second grade level, there were no books in that collection that anyone could use. School didn't have a school library. So I then went to and found a set of, first of all, some fourth and fifth grade readers, which I wasn't smart enough to realize they wouldn't be able to read those either. And so I, by the start of the second semester, I was enrolled in a graduate course on teaching kids to read. Okay. And I just remember the very first night, the professor saying, "Do you realize there are some people out there who still think that you can use a one-size-fits-all reading program? And how foolish are they?" And I remember thinking, I guess I better listen. And in fact, by the end of the year, I was actually beginning to learn how to teach kids to read. And the following year, I did a much better job. I became a reading specialist soon after that. And then I became a Title I program director in another small rural consolidated district. And did that for a couple of years. And actually went back to graduate school thinking I'd become a superintendent, only to discover that, and I was thinking that in part because I thought, well, superintendents at least don't have anybody telling them what to do. And then it dawned on me that the more I studied, the clearer it became that superintendents did have someone to make happy, and that was the school board. And so when I graduated, I interviewed for both administrative jobs and university teaching jobs, and along came a job offer from the University at Albany, and my advisor, who had been grown up in New York State, recommended I take it, and I did, and was there happily for 30 years.
Now that you have all this to look back on, what do you see as the most salient issues with the current state of reading instruction?
Well, I guess it depends on how I define salient. What I find most distressing is that I'm visiting classrooms where teachers are offering instruction that was no better than what I did in my first year of teaching kids to read. But for whatever reason, teachers today, elementary teachers in particular, take fewer courses in teaching and arrive in classrooms knowing even less than I did. And the solution to that has been to have them implement a large corporate machinery of one-size-fits-all basal reader programs, and to script the programs, and then to have folks walk around to make sure that they, and give them a pacing guide to tell them which pages they should be doing on which days, and then have people wandering around monitoring that you're on the right page at the right time of the right program. And, you know, if nobody has ever defined effective instruction as fidelity to a program, mm-hmm. for any number of reasons, not the least of which is that the folks that design the programs in Chicago or Dallas or Boston never met your kids, and they never met you. And the notion that there's one best way to teach something is just so silly that it's enough to make you die laughing, as they say.
You're saying that you see mostly whole group instruction, whole class instruction on the same texts when you go into classrooms?
I say that's what the federal government mandated under No Child Left Behind, Reading First, yes.
Uh-huh.
And even though Congress has now basically terminated funding for the Reading First program due to both its failure to improve reading achievement and the unadulterated corruption that the Inspector General found, the Reading First first lives on in many administrators and school districts' minds, and even in the minds of, here in Tennessee at least, of some state education department officials.
What kind of corruption?
Well, it's basically corruption that enriched a handful of people and a handful of publishing companies. All three of the technical assistance center directors for the Reading First program, that would be at Florida State, at University of Texas, and at the University of Oregon, were forced to resign their positions. Some retired, some did something else, and some, you know, got promoted to be a dean by their associate dean by their colleges. But they were outed, and it became clear that much of the guidance that was being offered by the centers and the U.S. Department of Education was so biased towards some certain products. The major issue was a test called DIBELS, which I think it was 41 of the 50 states adopted as their monitoring tool, even though the test was available free at the University of Oregon's website, and even though nobody has ever shown that it's much of a very, very useful. In fact, the website, the DIBELS website, says, you know, this is not an instructionally sensitive instrument, mm-hmm. and don't use it to plan instruction. And yet, all over this country, you know, kindergartners and first graders are being evaluated and being promoted or identified as having a disability if they can't read letters fast enough or nonsense syllables fast enough and so on. And in classroom after classroom, I see kids practicing in pairs reading nonsense syllables. One has the timer, and the other has the list, and then they switch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what we do know is that Reading First did, in fact, improve the ability of first graders to read nonsense syllables quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It did not improve their reading achievement in first grade, second grade, or third grade, however.
You've explained what you are upset with, a one-size-fits-all and particular companies pushing products. But what do you see as most important in effective reading instruction?
Well, probably the single most important factor is the teacher, and teachers who know how to teach children to read, and teachers who love children. And if Bob Pianta's work at the University of Virginia is a good indicator, and I think it probably is, that's about 25% of all teachers. And then another 50 or 60% of the teachers love children, but only kids who we would predict would become good readers will learn to read in their classrooms, and kids who struggle won't. And another 20% seem to neither like children nor be able to teach them.
You were saying that you felt that training, that you're going back and getting training, really helped you. What was it that you were trained in that made you more effective?
I became a reading specialist, and so I was trained in both the development of reading proficiencies, as well as diagnostic assessments for evaluating how kids are doing, as well as simply looking. You know, I mean, we do evaluation projects for school districts, and all it takes is about 30-person days, which is 10 days to a couple of weeks for, you know, three of us to go in and just walk around classrooms, and it's not hard to tell a district exactly what's wrong. And sometimes that's the district's fault, sometimes the state's fault, and sometimes it's the federal government's fault. It's rarely the teacher's fault. Most teachers teach as well as they can. But, you know, I've never understood why school districts think they get a pass compared to other employers, in that they hire people right out of college and give them the same responsibilities as someone who's been working for 10 years. Unlike other occupations, whether it's airplane pilots or insurance sales reps or customer service reps at the bank and so on, there's no internship, there's no intense training period, and there's no one, no guide or coach in most schools. Some have started to develop that, but in many cases the coach is simply not a coach to improve the quality of the reading instruction. It's a coach to ensure the fidelity of the instruction to the commercial program.
Let me ask you what you think of the Common Core state standards that are being adopted by, I think at this point, 47 states.
I think it'll be a boon for the publishers and the test makers,
mm-hmm.
and it'll make a national test much easier, none of which serves children well, but nor does it serve teachers well. I don't have anything wrong, there's nothing inherently wrong, and in many respects, if publishers actually reframe their instructional materials to match some of the new standards, and if they created assessments that actually measured kids' ability to engage in those standards, it would be a good thing. But I don't think they're going to. I've worked off and on with publishers for 30 years, and the reason I work off and on is that I'm yet waiting to find someone who actually has a commitment to producing research-based and instructionally useful materials. What they seem to understand is how to produce the same thing over and over again with lots of fancy labels that label the student performance indicators and so on by state and the materials so that people will think they designed the program just for them. But if they actually looked at it, they would they looked at the master copies, they would see all 50 states are getting the same program, and they just sort of randomly stick student performance indicators number 13.33 on this page so that everybody thinks that it's tailored for them, which means they sell a lot more. And state officials often think that they obviously, kids in Tennessee are just like kids in New Mexico, right? And that they somehow sent author teams out to observe in Tennessee classrooms to decide what would be a reasonable story selection for kids to read, and what kinds of problems Tennessee kids would have that Arizona kids or New Mexican kids would have.
But now, in terms of the actual standards, you were saying that you didn't see anything particularly objectionable in the standards. It's really the textbook companies and the money-making operations that you're upset with. Going back to the standards, are there any changes in the actual standards themselves that you would recommend?
Well, I would try to humanize them a little more, and I would worry less about complex text, if for no other reason than we're at the point where most adults realize if they click on a selection that they found on Google, that's too hard for them. If they click on the next one, they'll probably find one that's written in plainer language. I mean, that's what I did when I found out I had Meniere's syndrome, and it took me five different clicks before I finally found a plain language document from the National Institute of Health about what they called single-sided deafness. And after reading that and clicking on some more features that they had, they offered there, within a few days, I could go back and read some of the things that were out of the Journal of Otolaryngology and so on,
mm-hmm.
that came up first on the list. But I had to build the background knowledge in order to be able to read the complex text.
Well, now let me ask you, what do you think families should look for if they're evaluating the reading instruction that their students are experiencing in school?
For me, it's pretty simple. And that is your child engaged in reading every self-selected voluntary reading every evening and all in on the weekends and during the summers. And if he's not, then you ought to ask schools what the hell's going on.
Uh-huh.
Because we've been much more successful at creating kids who can read than creating kids who do read. I'm still trying to figure out how to present the data, but the National Endowment for the Humanities just recently published a report noting that that white kids ages 8 to 18 spend an average about 8.5 hours a day engaged in electronic media. Black Hispanic kids spend about 13 hours a day, and black kids spend almost 14 hours a day engaged in electronic media, which is defined as televisions, stereos, Game Boys, internet, cable television, and so on. And if you want your child to grow up stupid, let them watch more than 2 hours of television a week. But parents who, I mean, when you start looking, black kids are twice as likely as white kids to have a television in their bedroom. And I'm not sure how to explain the differences between, I mean, 8 hours and 14 hours. That's almost 6 hours a day.
What do you see in the next few years happening with reading instruction?
Well, I don't see much of a let up. That you know, we've got two large consortia determined to tailor the tests and the Common Core standards for those majority of states that have accepted them. And so I think we're just going to get more and more business as usual. And less and less. I mean, I can understand why publishers would just as soon have teachers who aren't very smart about teaching kids to read, because then they might start raising questions about what publishers are recommending, including the whole notion of a common text for everybody all the time. I mean, we learned from studying our exemplary teachers that in six states that what we called side-by-side teaching, which is when the teacher's right alongside the child, occupied the majority of their day. Teacher in front of the classroom, you know, either interrogating everyone or lecturing everyone, was perhaps 10% of the school day in our most effective teacher classrooms. That the least effective teachers or the less effective teachers, the teacher in front dominated the school day. What we now have is a national plan to put the teacher in front, make the kids be quiet, and make them do the work whether they're interested or not. And there's no need to excite kids. They all would love to read the writings of some 18th century poet.
We've just been talking to Richard Allington of the University of Tennessee. Our topic today was about the teaching of reading. Is there a best way? What I found interesting about today's discussion was that each of our guests, despite the differences in their approaches, was supportive of the recently developed Common Core State Standards. Perhaps this is because of the focus in these standards on higher order thinking and comprehension, and the emphasis on writing and oral language development. Our next program will be on teacher education. How can we best prepare teachers for the classroom? Should we bypass colleges of education? For more information about this series, go to our website at examineeducation.org. Our website also provides links to other sites that include additional details about the issues raised by each guest. We welcome your suggestions for future topics and your comments about what you heard today. So go to our website or follow us on Facebook, Examining Education. Today's program was produced with help from Managing Editor Jason Croft and audio support from Mike Pritchard. I'm the host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. This is Examining Education.